think that before we can change anything, we need to have the general public understand what's going on and what we're seeing and what it is that we see a problem with. And I feel that direct action is a great way to let people know that there are options out there that are different.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for the special hour-long look back at the news and features heard on Freak Radio during the 2001 Summer of Resistance. On this special program, we'll hear reports on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, medical neglect in California prisons, Santa Cruz Earth First actions, homeless organizing Camp Paradise, the G8 Summit protest in Genoa, Italy, and we'll hear poetry by Alex Olson and Marcus Rene Van, plus this summer's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. On July 20th and 21st, 2001, more than 100,000 people gathered in the streets of Genoa, Italy, to express dissent against the closed meetings of the G8, an association of the world's eight most economically powerful countries. They are Japan, Germany, England, Canada, France, Russia, Italy, and the United States. The G8 meets yearly to discuss general international policy direction. Demonstrators from all over Europe converged on Genoa to present alternative visions to the way the world's population could be organized to undo poverty, inequality, and environmental degradation. The Genoa Social Forum hosted speakers and organizers from around the world who talked at their counter-summit of alternatives to the current destructive economic policies pursued by Western governments, and massive numbers took to the streets to voice their opposition to the world's leaders gathering there. Demonstrations featured a mass action of organized civil disobedience attempting to break through the sealed-off red zone security barriers dividing the militarized town of Genoa. Italian police met the demonstrations with violence, resulting in serious injuries from both street clashes and raids on sleeping protesters. One young man, Carlo Giuliani, died from two gunshot wounds to his head and face. His lifeless body was then run over repeatedly by the fleeing police jeep. Hundreds more were injured or arrested in confrontations with police. Freak Radio's European correspondent, Roberto, was in Genoa and kept us up to date on the situation throughout the weekend.
It was a bit chaotic. The march was to be close to about 5 miles long or so, something like that. And right at around, I'd say the 3 mile point or something like that, coming into a major part of the city near the red zone was where most of the confrontation took place. And it was about a two-hour confrontation between police and an active group of maybe 30 demonstrators out front, and behind them was a group of maybe 700 to 1,000. And then the march was sort of, this is sort of difficult to explain by radio, but the march was peeling around heading north, and the action between the demonstrators and so on was to the direct west of them. It's a port city, Genoa, so it was, we were right on the Mediterranean as things were taking place. There were the confrontation with the police. There were about 200 police in front, maybe 50 police van vehicles, a couple of tanks behind them. And then to the south was the Mediterranean, where the Coast Guard was out there. The police were pretty much in control the whole time. I mean, when they wanted to move, they moved. And the standoff took a couple of hours. The police really began to move when some petrol bombs ignited some nearby buildings. And then they started moving on the demonstrators. But they were firing tear gas the whole time. Demonstrators were throwing them back. There seemed to be one demonstrator somewhere in the crowd that had a launcher of some sort and was firing petrol bombs, and at one point fired one actually quite far, and it hit a sports stadium that was back near the end of the police line and hit it on top, and it started ablaze and went ablaze for a while, but then went out on its own. Had that ignited, that would have been an incredible scene. This is a sports stadium, but that was the only shot that was fired for a long distance. All the other ones were rather shorter distances, of maybe 100 feet to 500-600 feet, no more than that.
Many participants have since reported that police infiltrators were responsible for the majority of confrontations. As the summit's official activities were wrapping up, Italian forces, reportedly trained by the L.A. County sheriffs, stormed the building that hosted the Independent Media Center with tear gas and batons. Across the street, in the school which housed the Genoa Social Forum, police entered at the same time. There, activists had baton blows rained down on them as they lay sleeping. Others were reportedly lined up against the walls and beaten bloodied. Witnesses reported seeing blood all over the halls of this building. More than 30 people were hospitalized after this raid and exposed to further psychological abuse from prison guards stationed there. Lena is from Napoli, Italy, and was involved in Italian street politics in the 1970s. About 14 years ago, she relocated to New York City but returned to Italy for the protests against the G8. In the days after Genoa, she joined Freak Radio's Hobo Lee and shared some of her reflections on the events there.
There were definitely some kind of, I would say, a little bit more fascistic attitude, especially when they destroyed the Independent Media Center and they attacked all the people who was there or was sleeping in a school near the media center.
Where
there was more than 60, 70 people in the hospital after they went in. And a lot of the people went straight from the hospital to the jail for 2-3 days.
Which would scare a lot.
They were not able to call lawyer or friends, nothing, which frankly I think it's a little bit too much even for regular imperialistic state.
And then it would scare a lot of people who needed medical treatment maybe to go to the hospital, knowing that they'd go to jail probably directly afterwards.
Well, that happened a lot even before they went to the media center. I mean, a lot of people who got beaten up during the demonstrations, they refused to go to the hospital. And that's not just something that I'm saying. There is video of a few people who were yelling and screaming, asking the doctor to don't take them to the hospital because the rumor was all over that there was Carabinieri police at the hospital taking the people to the jail even before the doctor were able to release some kind of document or stuff like that. Basically, I guess at this point there is not even doubt anymore that that's what happened, because there is 8 big investigations that are going on right now in Italy, and obviously this is some kind of answer to the international pressure. I think the media in Europe in general, they dealt with the G8 in general in a different way than the American media. There was a lot more coverage and it's still going on, actually.
Right.
The Financial Times, it's definitely non-progressive publication, or the Economist, they all are pretty clear about the situation in Genoa, about the police brutality and abuse.
In the aftermath of the violence surrounding the protests, 3 top-level police commanders have been reassigned in a widening probe of police misconduct. For up-to-the-minute reports, visit the Independent Media Center on the web at www.indymedia.org. Alex Olson is a young lesbian feminist slam poet who has been rousing spirits across the country with her dynamic performances. She is a member of the 1998 Nuyorican National Championship Poetry Slam Team and the 1999 Outright National Poetry Slam Champion. Alex has been published in The Lesbian Review of Books, Gathering of the Tribes, and was featured on the cover of Ms. Magazine's January edition. Her most recent release is a CD of her spoken word poetry called Built Like That. She joined The Fish in the studios for a discussion about the various aspects of slam poetry and fulfills a listener's request.
So what do you feel like the slam art form Do you think it's like more designed to be just like performance poetry, what are the various like positive aspects or negative aspects that you see within the genre or general?
I think that as an art form, it's almost entirely positive, in my experience, because I think that art is always going to be critiqued. There's always this sense that art has to be criticized and given a number and a ranking. You know, and if you look at who gets into glossy magazines and who gets into, you know, art museums and who gets into small galleries or Shishi in New York, there's always a sense of judgment. And that with slam poetry, it's an ironic sense of judgment because everyone gets to do it anyway. So who cares really what happens? And in any case, the audience is really the ones who are given the numbers, like, to be able to judge this poetry. And it was started with a sense of irony, and it still does have that tongue-in-cheek sensibility about it. And I think the negative is if it gets too swept up in capitalist culture and people forget that that's the origin, which often happens to grassroots art, that people forget the origin of it and becomes, you know, swallowed up in the corporate machinery. For example, like an MTV slam, I can see that.
Yeah.
But that's not the root and that's not the essence of slam poetry. And in its very essence, it's totally democratic. It makes artists accountable to the audience because the audience has them in their, you know, in their grip. They have this communication going on, and often art does its own thing. It doesn't really care about what people think about it, and I think that it makes it very, it creates a dialogue in a place where there has traditionally maybe not been a dialogue between poet and audience. And it also brings poetry to the world in this, like, global, sensible way. It talks about issues that are happening, and it, or at least it has a potential for that. So it's not simply esoteric, you know, wordplay, which is also wonderful, but it gives credibility to this other part of art, which is about just being based in the world and what's happening.
We had a request from a caller earlier that you do something live. You got anything in mind, or?
Sure.
Okay.
Do something live. Do a piece called Daughter. I wrote this piece because I was talking to my best friend who was doing a whole bunch of stuff that was really bad for her body, and I asked her when she was going to stop, and she said she would stop when she got pregnant because it would hurt the baby. So I started thinking about how we think about our children versus our bodies and ourselves, and our bodies ourselves. And I wrote this piece. It's called Daughter. I'll teach my daughter to bang on anything that makes a beat. She'll shake a boom, she'll quake a room, she'll paint her cheeks warrior style, then smile, beguile you, turn you inside out till your guts plead guilty. She'll be built like a truck, built to work you down as she works herself up. She'll make holes in the streets in her 10-inch spike heels, in combat boots, stilts on roller wheels. She'll stroll through male pride, Amazon babes at her side. She'll relinquish white privilege, observe, be wise. She'll compromise when the fire is stoked by other women's desires, but she'll never leave the flame. All the same, she'll crave what makes her burn. She'll learn her cunt's good name. The thick red lips, the small hot tip, no more of this cryptic shit. This vagina will be known. She'll park in all the wrong places, make faces at police cars, wind up behind bars, bust out big before serving her time. Fingernails full of this grime we call reality. She'll dig her way through. She'll pick her nose when she has to. She'll scratch her ass. She'll be a crass Medusa child, a wild, healthy fiend. She'll live in all fonts and all sizes. Curlicues, caps, italics, and bold. She'll fold airplanes out of shredded cosmos and mademoiselles, then pilot them to Never Say Never Land, where Peter Pan's gay and Wendy's okay with it. She'll wear thick braids, she'll shave her head, she'll eat thick breads, she'll let her breasts flop, she'll mop the floor like Cinderella, then with rebellion prowess, she'll unionize daughters for a higher allowance. She'll be male and female and in between. She'll preen, then crack her mirror, crack a beer, and watch Love Connection. She'll go for days without taking a shower, just to feel unchanged ivory slave power. She'll want more than what she's entitled to. She'll watch through Nike commercials and she'll just undo it. Ask who's making that shit, who's breaking their backs, keeping her breaking that glass ceiling. She'll do all of this and she'll do none of this. And it's funny how we hide behind these daughters, you know. Hide ahead of our own histories, scared of ourselves, scared of the world, scared of someone who made us one way or another. Well, this time around, I'll be bound to my own mind womb. In my own birthing room, I'll squeeze out each crimson thick belief, then eat each pungent sweet placenta, and relieved I will tear up this country's welcome to the world certificate, tear off my father's name. I'll legitimate my own entrance into a thinking existence. I will birth myself towards resistance. But no frantic tick-tock of this biological clock. On my own time, four mothers at my side, sisters as midwives, I'll cut my cord, head for that war. I will birth myself into this drum-beating bastard child, head first. Head first. Mind first. Mine first. I will mother myself into my own grown daughter, and I will call myself a home-grown woman.
Marcus Rene Van, a 25-year-old transgender dyke poet, is an exciting, edgy, thought-provoking poet who has won national slam contests and toured with the Sister Spit Ramblin' Road Show. She joined Freak Radio's Earth Mommer in the studio, and here she does a piece called Welfare Profits.
Okay, for Earth Mommer, this is called Welfare Profits. My mother was one of the many prophets of the food stamp Bible. My mother was one of the many prophets of the food stamp Bible. She spent her welfare proverbs and WIC prophecies on Cheerios and government cheese. She was a Mary Magdalene of fast food chains. She whored herself scrubbing Wendy's floors and McDonald's grills. And even worse still, she did hard time servicing Kmart lines. All to get that $5 an hour paycheck that she would never see because moms had five disciples at home to feed. And they say you reap what you sow. Plant many seeds. You reap what you sow. Plant many seeds. Well, if that shit was true, then my mother's field would be overgrown with prosperity. But instead, it is barren and dead like their promised land. My mother was the David to this Goliath world, hurling stones at rock walls, waiting in welfare lines for her number to be called. She was meeting the blank stares of government clerks and said to get a job, mammy, get your ass to work. Never mind that in her womb she's birthed the workers for the new century, the ones who will pay for their social security. She learned the lessons of Daniel in the lion's den from the government, but she did not escape unscathed like that prophet on the page. Instead, she is bruised and bloodied like the womb that birthed their blue-eyed Jesus. And they say that their Jesus is the one who died for me, their Jesus is the one who died for me. But I never saw him slaving or braving the woes of the world or raising not one but two black sons, trying hard to save us from the guns of the street or even worse, police brutality. And they say that their Jesus is the one who died for me. Well, if that Jesus was born a yellow-black woman, then maybe I'd believe them. My mother was one of the many prophets of the food stamp Bible. She was forgotten like the unheeded practices of Leviticus. She did not rise from the dead like Lazarus. She did not walk on water or part the Red Sea. And because of this system, her Israelites will never be free. But she did play the role of both black woman and black man. She raised five kids with single hands, bathed the earth with black mother tears, and did more in a day than we do in a year. So tell me, why is she still treated like the AFDC freight that scrapes beneath the bottoms of our feet? Can you hear her prophecies?
One out of every seven American families, or 6 million households, has a critical housing need. The Department of Housing and Urban Development defines critical housing need as spending more than half of the family's income on housing and or living in severely inadequate situations. Santa Cruz County has had an unprecedented increase in the cost of housing over the last decade, and the situation has become critical in recent years. About half of all households in the county spend 50% of their monthly income on housing, and of those, 34.8% pay more than 75%. This includes many working families whose modest incomes cannot meet the cost of decent housing. Median income households have been priced out of owning a house, condo, or even a mobile home. Lower income working people and those on fixed incomes are moving away or crowding into ever smaller spaces because rents have been raised beyond what they can afford. A significant increase in homelessness has resulted. Over 9% of households in Santa Cruz County earning less than $15,000 per year have experienced homelessness at some time in the last 12 months, and as many as 8,500 people in the county are homeless at some point over the period of a year. About a third of the 3,300 people currently homeless in Santa Cruz County are employed, and one-tenth are working full-time. Yet nobody can find a place to live. But in January, a group of homeless people got together to directly change their situation. Freak Radio's Skidmark Bob has the details.
Situated along the east bank of the San Lorenzo River in Santa Cruz, California, about 500 yards past Highway 1 overpass, lies Camp Paradise, an area that was notorious as a hangout for drug dealers. Neglected for years by Santa Cruz City officials, about a dozen houseless people moved into the area in January 2001 and began to plant vegetable gardens and clean tons of trash which littered the area.
This river, one spot we carried 4,800 pounds from.
Larry Templeton is one of the founders of Camp Paradise. He says Camp Paradise was started in response to a stabbing along the river and as a drug and alcohol free safe haven for people with nowhere to sleep.
What is wrong with people that's traveling around the world at their own expense? Nobody else is paying their way. And if this person wants to lay down in a safe place to sleep in your community, shouldn't he have that right?
But a Santa Cruz ordinance on the books since 1978 forbids setting up a campsite with the intention of spending the night. The infamous camping ban carries a $54 fine. Chris Foy, a resident of Camp Paradise, describes the ordinance.
They're not offering you any place to sleep. Sleeping from 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. to sleep at any time between those hours. The following places: outdoors, with or without bedding, tent, hammock, or other similar protection or equipment. So they want you to sleep on the ground with nothing. In, on, or under any structure not intended for human occupancy, whether with or without bedding, tent, hammock, or other similar protective equipment. In, on, under any parked vehicle.
A first citation is an infraction, but campers risk arrest and a misdemeanor charge and jail time if ticketed twice within 24 hours. For months, Camp Paradise quietly cleaned up the area and attracted more residents. But when reports began to surface about the open-air shelter, city officials took notice. Ironically, city leaders claim that the camp poses an environmental threat and that sanctioning it would set a dangerous precedent to the city's estimated 1,000 other homeless campers. But they say enforcement is a low priority. A July 1st deadline to remove the campsite came and went with campers staying put. Then on August 3rd, about 8 a.m. in the morning, Santa Cruz police issued more than 60 tickets to campers along the east and west bank of the river, including 33 tickets to residents of Camp Paradise. Vouchers for a two-night stay at a local motel were given to a few Camp Paradise residents who were ticketed, but most of those were gone before the police even arrived. Camp resident Rich Parsons was one of those ticketed.
They came to the tent, shook the tent, asked us to come out, asked us if we had an identification. I gave him the identification. He wrote me the ticket. Then he gave me a form to go over and get a two-day voucher for a motel room. Instead to get out of camp. That's the only way I can have a voucher if I get out of camp.
Camp Paradise founder Larry Templeton was singled out for additional environmental charges. Again, camp resident Chris Foy.
Everybody was cited underneath the camping ban, the section 636.10. Everybody was cited underneath that, and then Larry was cited underneath a couple of other specifics, such as public nuisance, mutilation of plants, legal refuge, and then we've got altering the stream bed.
That charge is related to the camp's riverside fish pond. Lieutenant Patty Sapone of the Santa Cruz Police Department described the ticketing as, quote, routine. But the supporters of Camp Paradise feel that the police are trying to avoid charges of selective enforcement on issuing tickets to other campers along the river. The residents of Camp Paradise don't know if the police will be back to evict them permanently or if they will be arrested for trying to stay. Again, Rich Parsons.
They told me that they would be back in 2 days, and I says, is that when you're going to come back and arrest me because I'm trespassing or what? He says that's subject to whatever happens at that time.
For now, the folks at Camp Paradise aren't giving up their riverside homestead in the hopes that city officials will see a positive contributions they have made in cleaning out the drug dealers and the trash from the area, as explained by resident Ghost.
It would literally cost the city, you know, another arm of its police force just to police this area, you know, to keep all of that out. And we're doing it for free. We're doing it for free because we want to live here. We want to stay here. We would love nothing better than a resolvement of this issue and allow us to stay. Let us adopt this section of river like people adopt a highway program.
Right.
Clean it up. Keep it. Maintain it. Let the good people of this city come down and walk through in a clean, safe environment like it was a park.
The campers are also hopeful that a compromise can be reached and city officials will realize that the problems of homelessness will not go away by evicting them. Again, Larry Templeton.
We're looking for a piece of land.
Uh-huh.
We can rent from someone. We showed them that we can do the right thing to the pieces of ground that has been like a city dump. We took this city dump and we made it look nice.
Reporting for Freak Radio Santa Cruz, my name is Skidmark Bob.
Santa Cruz officials have offered to dismiss the August 3rd camping tickets if they are moved out of Camp Paradise by September 1st. Six of the campers have agreed to this deal. The issue will be discussed at the September 4th City Council session. The Dolly Ranchers are an all-female band made up of wanderers, hobos, and clowns that is loosely affiliated with the all-woman One Railroad Circus. Citing an array of musical influences like Tom Waits, Patti Smith, Freakwater, Utah Phillips, and Loretta Lynn, the Dolly Ranchers' music is country western that's a little edgy, but delicate at heart. Their twing-twangy sound is punctuated by lead singer Sarah Jane Moody's in-your-face lyrics. The Dolly Ranchers made a stop in Santa Cruz for the last show of their West Coast tour. They joined Freak Radio's Hobo Lee in the studio for a live, on-air performance. Here's the Dolly Ranchers with this summer's spotlight sound, Swan Island.
Well, I think this might be our last song, so thank y'all for listening, and come out tonight to Henflings. It's our last West Coast show until January. While Maurice is tuning, this tune's called Swan Island. It's we actually, first time we played it was at a hobo fest in Elko, which was really exciting to premiere the song there. And it's somewhat relevant to travelers and hobos alike, because well, you'll just have to find out. Thank you.
come back anytime now. You know how to find me, we can put all that trouble behind. Hey, you my friend, will you blow in with a new spring wind? I know you're out there again, shaking like a wet dog in the rain. If you wanna come in, I'll leave the door open. I won't ask where you've been. Come to me all the way from our mad traveling days. I'll be glad to see you again.
From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show. Please stay tuned for our contact information at the end of this special hour-long broadcast.
Logging of Douglas fir and redwood trees near Boulder Creek, California was halted for nearly 4 hours on July 24, 2001 after two young women locked themselves to an access gate preventing trucks from entering the area. Redwood Empire, an out-of-county logging operation based in Cloverdale, California, has state approval for the 117-acre timber harvest plan, but activists with Santa Cruz Earth First contend that the company's practice of cable yarding on steep slopes to remove trees threatens a critical watershed area along the San Lorenzo River. In mid-June, Earth First activists set up a tree sit in the area after other methods failed to stop the timber harvest plan. According to Wind, an Earth First activist, the July 24th protest was in response to increasing threats of violence directed at the tree sitters.
Loggers decided to climb up trees around the tree sit and cut traverse lines that were going to redwood trees surrounding the Doug fir. One traverse line was even cut while our friend was up attached to it, and if he hadn't been safetied to the platform, he would have fallen about 100 feet.
He also said that in the days prior, someone threw rocks at the tree sitters, and they reported hearing gunfire in the area on the day before the lockdown. The tree sitter used a cell phone to report the gunshots, and when a sheriff's deputy arrived about 8 hours later, he refused to take a report unless the activist came down from his perch. The July 24th demonstration was an act of solidarity organized by local citizens who are not active with Earth First, but are concerned about the escalation of violence.
A lot of the people out there doing support for the blockade haven't really been involved with Earth First before. We follow what's going on and stuff, but we haven't really been doing tree sits or anything like that. So there were a number of people there. As soon as we heard that shots had been fired at activists, we sort of rallied around, and I thought it was really cool to see like people who live in Santa Cruz and believe in direct action getting together with people who've been doing more stuff with Earth First. And, you know, working together on that.
Jesse Nason is one of those supporters and was present at the scene. When a logging crew arrived at the site, Jesse was nearly run down.
When he came roaring up in his pickup truck and intentionally swerved and tried to hit me, and I had to jump up on the bank of alongside the road so that I didn't get killed. Can you imagine if the roles had been reversed and Earth First had tried to hit a logger with their truck? We wouldn't hear the end of it. We'd be charged with attempted murder, and we'd be in jail without bail, probably.
19-year-old Sarah Hollis, along with her 21-year-old sister Dune, were locked to either side of the gate, preventing trucks from passing. I asked them to explain their motivations for taking such an action.
When I heard that shots had been fired at our people, that just said to me that something needed to be done, and I think that before we can change anything, we need to have the general public understand what's going on and what we're seeing and what it is that we see a problem with. And I feel that direct action is a great way to let people know that there are options out there that are different from what Redwood Empire is telling us.
The only way that we're going to get things done is
to take action, whether it be verbal action or physical action, because change needs to happen quickly. And I believe that what was going on in the woods out there is just a smaller reflection of a greater problem.
About 15 people on hand to support the lockdown sisters had constructed a makeshift road blockade out of some nearby branches and wood. At the sight of this, the two loggers became enraged and began to assault some of the male protesters present. What you are about to hear is from a video taken by one of the supporters and contains very strong language.
Mother Nature's trying to reclaim the road.
Yeah, I think you better get your fucking,
ass up here and get this out of here.
Want me to show you?
No, not really.
Get over here and get this wood cleaned up now.
Get it cleaned up.
You put it in there? Did you put it in there?
Hear me?
Now you get up here and clean that wood.
You know what?
Get up here and clean it up. Clean the wood up. Clean the wood up first. You get up here and you clean this wood out of here. You guys put it here, you clean it out.
You got the wood out of the road, you little fucking shit.
We need to have the sheriff come up here right now.
Now get this wood cleaned up and get it cleaned up now.
You don't understand either? Get up here and
clean
the wood.
You little
punk. You fucking shithead.
You little punk.
I'm going away all the way.
You little punks need to clean this out of here. You put it there, clean it out. You're the assholes that put it there. Get up here and clean it out.
But you ain't understand it?
I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure what good that's going to do you with them.
Don't worry about what good it's going to do me. What, you think you're agile?
Not particularly.
You goddamn right you are.
No, I'm not here to hurt you.
You clean the wood up.
Hurt me.
Now get busy.
You dumb shit.
That's why I'm.
You guys ain't done a fucking thing all day. Now get the wood out of here.
Get to work. You having a problem understanding? Huh?
Just so you know, we will be taking something
from here. Oh, you can fucking stick the charges up your ass.
This continued in this vein for some time before deputies with the Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Office arrived and ordered the assembled activists to vacate the property. When asked if assault charges would be brought against the loggers, the sheriff's media liaison, Deputy Kim Allen, had this to say.
There are some allegations that one of the protesters was blocking the roadway and a logger apparently got out and pushed the guy or individual out of the path of his truck and continue on through so he could work. We're having a real difficult time following up on it. There's a deputy writing report about the incident. So until I know further on it, we're working to try to get the, if this did in fact happen, and is if it is in fact a crime, which right now we don't know what we have. So it's a really difficult task for us. We're just trying to maintain peace and protect your, you know, right to peaceful protest, you know, nonviolent tree war versus property rights. The laws that are on the book regarding, you know, protecting property rights. And we're staying out of the controversy in regards to whether people should cut trees down or not.
To date, no charges have been filed against the loggers. The two sisters, Sarah and Dune, refused to unlock themselves, and firefighters were summoned to remove the gate they were wrapped around. Once cut out, the sisters were handcuffed and transferred to Santa Cruz County Jail, where they were booked on charges of trespassing. They have since pled no contest in court and paid a small fine. An employee with Redwood Empire went on record to state the company's position about the protest.
The company has no comment regarding it, and if we have any comment, we'll send it out to those that have expressed an interest, but it'll be a written comment only.
A few days later, on July 29th, one of two tree sitters was down on the ground when a man apprehended him at gunpoint. Morph called into Freak Radio from atop the tree just after this incident occurred.
And I look down, and there's a logger there, and he has him at gunpoint. Last thing I know is that the logger, I heard him talking on his cell phone. He was talking about how he didn't want to call the sheriff for some reason, so I called the sheriff just to make sure that they don't do something crazy.
The Redwood Empire employee apparently kidnapped the young male activist with what turned out to be a paint gun. The unidentified protester was then taken to county jail and booked for trespassing. But Santa Cruz Earth First is a very determined group. On August 13th, another action occurred, as Earth First Radio's Uncle Dennis explains.
Activists in Boulder Creek erected a road blockade known as a dragon in the haul road to the Sykes 2 timber harvest plan and effectively blocked that road, stopped all hauling of timber out of the Sykes-Tude Timber Harvest Plant for about 5 hours. And folks don't know what a dragon is. Dragon is basically a disabled car planted in the middle of the road, and then the activist who is defending the dragon sticks his arm down into a hole in the ground where there's a metal bar cemented into the ground, and he locks himself onto that metal bar cemented into the ground and thereby locks the dragon into place on the road. It took the sheriff's department, the landowner, and I don't know who else about 5 hours to get him out.
Once removed, the young man was booked into Santa Cruz County Jail on felony charges and is currently being held in lieu of $10,000 bail. Opponents of Redwood Empire's logging in Santa Cruz County saw a glimmer of hope 2 days later when a 5-year-old lawsuit against the company was settled. In 1996, the company began to use a road owned by Kathy Dean and Nick Gombos in order to haul logs out of the Gamecock Canyon and Ramsey Gulch areas. To Earth Firsters who erected the Ramsey Gulch tree sit in June 2000, the August 15th Superior Court ruling is a bittersweet victory. While it does mean that Redwood Empire must stop logging in the area, the company's years of tree removal destroyed the habitat, and Dean and Gombos have since been forced to move north to Oregon as a result of the pressure from Redwood Empire. In the meantime, Santa Cruz Earth First is occupying 2 timber harvest plants in the county. To learn more about their efforts or to offer support, contact them at cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. You're listening to the Weekly Freak Show in our look back at the 2001 Summer of Resistance. Please stay tuned. From August 11th through the 15th, the American Correctional Association, an organization of corporations that profit off the prison industrial complex, held their annual conference and trade show in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Several hundred prison activists and community members gathered in Philly for a counterconference, 4 days of marches, workshops, lectures, and discussions dedicated to formulating alternatives to the U.S. prison industrial complex. Topics ranged from criticism of the American Correctional Association to denouncement of the death penalty and the criminalization of sex workers. Another goal of the counter-conference was aimed at addressing inadequate health care of the growing prison population. At the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, between November 2000 and February 2001, 10 women prisoners have died as a result of medical neglect and the refusal of guards and staff to provide life-saving medical treatment. Judy Greenspan is with the HIV Hepatitis C in Prison Committee of California Prison Focus, a statewide advocacy organization fighting for the human rights of prisoners and against brutality by guards. She joined Freak Radio's Old Lady Scar Arms to discuss some of the realities faced by women incarcerated in California's prison system.
Medical care in prison is very different than medical care on the outside. It's laced with punishment. It has a very adversarial nature. The way that prison doctors conduct physicals is to stand on one end of the room and look at you and say, okay, you're all right. There's very little touching. There's very little consideration of the very serious illnesses that many of these prisoners already have.
Is there an attitude of you're faking?
Absolutely, and that's throughout the system. There's one of the first things that any doctor going into correctional medicine learns is that all these prisoners are malingerers or they're liars, they're just trying to get off work. You know, one example of this sort of mentality that gave rise to a couple of deaths at the Central California Women's Facility, back in early December, a woman by the name of Pamela Coffey was in extreme distress. She was writhing on the floor of her cell, and her cellmates were banging on the cell trying to get a nursing assistant that, in California, that guards who are licensed LVNs, which is licensed vocational nurses, they're the gatekeepers, what we call the gatekeepers to medical care. They're called MTAs, medical technical assistants. We've always said that you shouldn't have guards providing medical care, but in California they do. So while this woman was writhing on the floor of the cell and gasping for breath, the MTA came by and looked at her and said, there's nothing wrong with you. There's nothing we can do with you. You might as well stay with your cellmates. They'll take better care of you. He refused to let her out of the cell to go to the infirmary, and she died 2 hours later of what it turns out was a massive heart attack. if they had taken her out, popped her cell, taken her out immediately to the hospital, it's possible she would be alive today. But I think one of the most insidious things that happened after her death, and there was another woman, Jody Fitzgerald, who had all sorts of problems, and she kept complaining of being very ill and wanting to go to the doctor. And the MTA looked at her and said, oh, there's nothing wrong with you. I think it's just in your head. So they actually took her to the mental health unit, and she died literally hours later, again, sort of unexamined. She had liver failure. She had severe hepatitis C and other complications. But I think that one of the worst things was that after this whole spate of deaths at the Central California Women's Facility, what the prison tried to do was they tried to cover it up and they tried to say, oh, there's nothing wrong with our medical care. It must have been a bad batch of drugs. Or maybe these women were mixing drugs and liquor. And they actually put out a major memo. They sent it out to the prison. They spread it to the press saying basically the deaths were on these women. It wasn't the prison system. A couple of months later, when their own internal investigators, because there was no external investigation, their internal investigators, who were doctors from UC Davis, came up with the report. They basically said if these women had received more timely medical care, first of all, none of the women had any drugs in their system other than those prescribed by the prison. None of them had any alcohol in their system. Pamela Coffey was not on drugs or alcohol. She died of a heart attack, and they said in her case, in the case of Jody Fitzgerald, in the case of Stephanie Hardy, had they received prompt care, they would be alive today.
You mentioned these medical technical assistants. What kind of training do these guards slash medical assistants have?
They've had a year of nursing assistant courses. Basically, that's what an LVN is. Many of them, however, got their LVN licenses when they were in the Army. You know, Army medical care doesn't exactly prepare you for dealing with the complex problems that women prisoners face in prison. Besides the fact that most of the women coming into prison are poor, they've been medically neglected. Large numbers of women of color, given the racist injustice of the criminal justice system. Many of them are coming in already medically underserved. Some of them are coming in pregnant. Some of them have prenatal problems. Some of them have gynecological problems. Many of them have hepatitis C, which unfortunately, we estimate probably about 75% of people in prison have hepatitis C. None of this can really adequately be treated by medical technical assistants that got their license while they were in the Army. I mean, the Army is basically, at this point, filled with fairly healthy people. And Army sick call is very, very different than infirmary care or emergency medical care. And prisons, in general, are just not set up to deal with the complexities of the medical problems that prisoners have, particularly women prisoners.
And these medical technical assistants that have had a year of nursing training. These people are responsible for the majority of the health?
They are responsible for deciding whether or not somebody should go see a doctor.
And they're really not qualified for
qualified for that, and also they're guards. They're prison guards. You know, they dispense medication, they do some preliminary diagnoses, and it's almost like if you can imagine going to a state trooper for your annual physical exam. That's really what it's like. Many of these MTAs already have a very adversarial relationship in their guard capacity with these women and men prisoners, and it's not, shall we say, a very healthy situation.
Wasn't there a bill introduced recently?
There was a bill introduced by Senator Kuehl, which would have basically, within a year, forced MTAs to choose. It would have done away eventually with the MTA position and forced MTAs to choose whether to be corrections officers or nursing assistants. It would have separated their powers. However, given the omnipotence and power of the California Correctional Peace Officers Association, which is the Guards Union and probably one of the most powerful political action committees and richest political action committees in the state, that part of the bill was quickly gutted. Actually, even before it came to committee, that was amended out of the bill. So that now Senator Kuehl's bill basically, if it passes and if Governor Davis signs it into law, would basically do away with the $5 copayment that is now being charged prisoners to go to see a doctor. And that's fine, and we've always been opposed to the sick call copayment, but we were hoping, of course, that there would be some broader changes like liquidating the MTA position.
Is it still worthwhile for people to support SB 396?
Oh, sure, absolutely. There was several women, for example, at Valley State Prison for Women who have died, many probably all over the state, who hesitated to go to the sick call when they had serious medical problems because they didn't want to be charged $5.
At the corner of 13th and Locust Streets in Center City, Philadelphia, it was business as usual on the morning of Friday, August 17, 2001.
This, however, is no ordinary intersection. It was here on December 9, 1981, that Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner was found mortally injured with a gunshot wound to the head, and the beginning of a nightmare for Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was found guilty of that murder in 1982 and sentenced to death.
They say death row, we say hell no. They say death row, we say hell no. They say death row, we say hell no.
A few blocks away outside the Criminal Justice Center, about 1,000 of Jamal's supporters gathered to demand justice for a man they say was wrongly convicted. At the original trial, Jamal was regularly banned from the proceedings and denied the right to self-representation, evidence was suppressed or misplaced, and witnesses were intimidated into giving false testimony. Jamal lost his first round of state appeals, and the case is now before Federal District Court Judge William H. Yon Jr., but his latest petition argues that the defense has new evidence to clear him. That evidence includes a confession by a man named Arnold Beverly, who claims he was hired by corrupt elements within the Philadelphia Police Department to kill Faulkner because the 25-year-old officer had interfered with mob payoffs to police. Last month, Judge Yon refused to order Beverly to testify on Abu-Jamal's behalf.
This is about a man named Arnold Beverly who came forth and stated he killed their brother. They should be ensuring that if this man said he killed their brother, that he should be allowed to come in and be examined by the district attorney to find out whether his story is true. We've investigated the story, and the story is very clear that this man was on the scene. This man pulled the trigger that killed police officer Daniel Faulkner.
Pam Africa is a key organizer with the international concerned family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who led Friday's demonstration. In his ruling, Judge Yon cited the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which established a one-year time limit to present new evidence in court.
If information comes out that he is innocent, yeah, they may say legally it's too late, but we ain't interested in legality. We're interested in what's right. We're interested in justice. God damn it, slavery was legal, but it wasn't right.
Ramona Africa is the sole adult survivor of the 1985 bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia, herself a former political prisoner. Jamal was ordered to appear in state court for a hearing requesting a new Post-Conviction Relief Act hearing, but was barred from attending after an official with the Philadelphia prison system violated Judge Pamela Dembe's order on the grounds that there was no room to house Mumia. A statement from Jamal, in which he detailed constitutional violations of his right to self-representation, was read to the court by his lead attorney, Marlene Kamish.
18 years ago, Judge Sabo unjustly banned me from virtually half of my trial. Today I am banned from a proceeding in my name, in my defense, without reason or justification.
Judge Dembe postponed any action on Mumia's request for a new hearing in the Pennsylvania courts, saying she wanted to hear more arguments on the prosecution's claim that the deadline had passed for the admission of the Arnold Beverly confession. She set a deadline of September 7th for Mumia's lawyers to submit arguments on why their petition is still timely, and she gave the prosecution 2 weeks to respond. Once those arguments have been filed, the judge will rule on whether to proceed or to dismiss Mumia's petition. Pat Thedick and Justin Sane, members of punk band Anti-Flag, traveled from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to attend the court proceedings.
The tragedy of it all and the realizing how slow everything happens and how they can drag things out for 20 years that they've dragged it out so far. It's just sort of, you file these papers, you file those papers, which is, you know, it's classic legal system.
Just the idea that the prosecution does whatever they can to fuck Mumia and keep him, or anybody on death row for that fact, and how they work to keep someone in jail just through legal complications.
Also in the courtroom to observe the hearing were a number of well-known figures, including actor Ossie Davis.
The people ultimately decide. It is up to us to make sure the courts know that our will is justice for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
In some sense, Mumia is the stream of the ugliness of our system. To send the too many innocent people in jail and too many guilty people in the streets in high places. But then, don't you stop there. There is the burden of day to take this case all around our nation, because in some sense, Mumia's predicament reflects the predicament of all of us. Until he is freed, none of us are free, we're just released.
A delegation of Korean activists attended the protest, as did representatives from Barcelona, Spain, and Puerto Rico. Bernard Besnier is the mayor of Bobigny, France.
Oui, mon gars, nous sommes venus aujourd'hui avec une délégation française très importante.
We came here today with a very important French delegation.
Et nous avons remis aux avocats 160 000 pétitions.
We gave the lawyers of Mumia 160,000 petitions from France.
At the end of the court hearing, the demonstrators assembled outside took their message to the streets. After marching around City Hall, they made their way to the federal courthouse at 6th and Market Streets, stopping at intersections along the way to let the public know about Mumia's case. Once there, speakers talked of the need to heighten awareness of Jamal's innocence and addressed overall problems with capital punishment. After an hour or so of speeches, the procession made its way back to City Hall. The march through downtown was peaceful, but as it neared City Hall, a construction crew working on a Wyndham Hotel building owned by the Marriott Corporation with ties to the private prison industry shouted epithets at the crowd and hung a banner which read, "Fry Mumia."
And we got to know, because there are union people down here for Mumia, that these lowlifes are not union. They are scabs. I know, as union people for Mumia, that is a scab. That is scab water for a boss man. That is not
scab.
This incident caused some confusion, and a standoff seemed imminent as police moved into formation around the building. But cooler heads prevailed, and the crowd continued on to City Hall for another rally. The crowd slowly dispersed as the day wore on, vowing to continue the fight for justice in this case. Reporting from Philadelphia, this is the V-Man for 96.3 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And that's all the time we have. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced in the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on the A-Info's radio project on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.net. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all, 24 hours a day, listen to our live stream at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to FRSC@microradio.net. That's FRSC@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That address, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. Thanks to Skidmark Bob, Old Lady Scar Arms, The Fish, Bill Free, Uncle Dennis, Earth Mommer, and Hobo Lee for contributing material in this program. For everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.